Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
There's been continued disorder in parts of the UK overnight. Six people have been arrested in Plymouth, with Dorset and Cornwall police saying there was sustained violence. Armed Forces Minister and MP for Plymouth, Luke Pollard, posted a video on X.
There is absolutely no place for violence on our streets. There's no place for hate on our streets. Plymouth is a brilliant place to live, work and play. The diversity of our city makes us stronger, doesn't make us weaker.
At least four people have been killed after Hurricane Debbie hit Florida. Three people died in car crashes, while a boy was killed when a tree fell on a mobile home. A US judge has ruled that Google's owner Alphabet acted illegally to maintain a monopoly over the search engine market. Google's found to have paid millions to other tech companies such as Apple and Samsung to remain as the default search option on their products. Alphabet says that it will appeal. That's the latest from Radio News Hub. I'm Stephen Davis.
Coming up, Africa in Focus.
I hope you've got your ID, because it's time to vote for me. The options are me, me, and me. And if you fail to vote, then you get nothing. As in, we cut off the broadcast to your home and all your devices. This is how our votes work. Actually, no, here's what you can do. You can vote for me or Steve Quirk. So that means you vote for me. That's Colourful Drive, every weekday from 4 till 7, with myself, the Mixmaster Mac. Make sure you vote for me, by the way. Every weekday, make sure.
On Colourful Radio.
Oh yeah, make sure you bring your ID.
Hey, yo. Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colourful.com, and apps. This is Colourful Radio.
Africa in Focus.
Colorful.
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 Genius.
Colorful
radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, or even good evening, depending on the time zone that you're connecting with us from. Welcome to Africa in Focus. I'm your host, Julius Baluto, and we're coming to you from the heart of London to wherever you are on Colorful Radio. So join us. Another opportunity to chat about Africa. Africa, such a great place, but our focus a bit more on Kenya, the protest. But away from the talking about the protest by Gen Z, perhaps maybe we needed to focus a bit more on the bigger issues, like what is the driving force of all this. And I want to, of course, to introduce, Reverend is not very new to you listeners. He's a broadcaster, great friend of mine, Jonas Awoo. Welcome to the program before we go further.
Always a pleasure to be here, Julius. Thank you.
Yeah. IMF has approved $570 million to Zambia as a country. Actually, they approved $1.7 billion to give to Zambia in form of a loan. Now, we see African countries getting loans from the IMF again. And we know, me and you know, most countries in Africa are going faced east. They had gone to China. Because you know the difference between Chinese loans and the IMF, the Chinese, they don't talk about your democracy. It's up to you.
Yeah,
IMF,
absolutely.
They control. And if you remember very well, Jonas, early 90s, African countries' economies were massacred by IMF. They came with what
absolutely.
They used to call SAPs, structural and adjustment
yes.
programs. They used
yes.
to give precondition. They tell you, we give you this amount of money on condition that you are going to change your political systems. What does that do to sovereignty of nations? And before we go there, we are talking about that because actually what we are seeing happening in Kenya is as a result of these IMF loans.
I, first and foremost, again, pleasure to be on the platform, Julius. And, you know, the moment we bring up the Washington Consensus, known as the IMF, you know, alarm bells start ringing all over, particularly if you've taken you know, you've done the research and you realize what these institutions actually do, then, you know, one will assume that many of the African countries will be very cautious when seeking an IMF bailout. But unfortunately, this is where we find ourselves. And, you know, the IMF in itself, right, as the former president of Ghana once said, that this institution is just another way of controlling many African countries. Yes, the old way of colonization is gone, but here we are, it's a new form called imperialism. And funny enough, after he wrote his book, which more or less decoded the schemes and the plots of the West, particularly the US, he was overthrown. And one thing he said was, these institutions will come in a way as they're looking to support you economically. But in the end, they tie you up and they take control. And we've seen it happen in most cases. And I think more recently, if we want to look at it carefully and look at what's happening globally around us, it's the same old tricks, which means having these countries or claiming to support them at the same time, trying to align themselves or trying to get these countries to align themselves with the you know, the West, I will call them. So if you look at what's happening right now, you did make mention of China right now. So now, yes, it's a struggle going on. China, Russia, and you have the West. Okay, and every country, most countries have come up to show who they're affiliated with or they pay their allegiances to. And this is one of the main components that the West uses, which is the IMF bailouts, which many countries are unable to pay their debts. So what happens is they need financial assistance. And what that means, which you mentioned in your introduction, the structural adjustment programs, SAP, which means that IMF is coming in to tell you, you don't know how to run your affairs, so I'm here to teach you, to tell you what to do. And when that happens, there's tax hikes. So any government programs becomes standstill. And then taxes on everything. And then when that happens, of course, the citizens are going to suffer. And this is what we've seen happening constantly. And when countries or citizens are suffering, what happens? Protests. There's unrest, because now we know the cost of living and taxes rising up. It's just unbelievable. Before we came on, I was watching a live feed from Kenya, actually, with these young journalists were actually explaining what we're talking about now. And I said, oh my goodness, they understand. They know what this is. It's bigger than just Kenya. They're looking at the IMF. So this is what the IMF does. It doesn't help. It doesn't help. We're hearing billions, millions, billions being given to these African countries. It's not for free. It's not for free. So it's a vicious cycle that we keep falling into the trap constantly and constantly and constantly. And when it gets to a point where it's a breaking point, then the people will rise up. And this is what we're seeing right now in Kenya.
Now, what has happened in Kenya has inspired a lot of Africans across the continent. Absolutely. They're like saying, yes, that is the beginning of voice of the people overturning imperialism. So it's not just about a mere protest among us Kenyans. But, yeah. Jonas, what we have seen is a very different, shall I call it, dispensation in Kenya, basically. You have a huge chunk across the country, techno-safi generation, who have organized themselves digitally, and they managed to pull out the most powerful movement you'll ever see. They kicked out politicians. They didn't want any of them to come near them, lest they claim credit.
Yeah.
Even the leader of opposition, Raila Odinga, who always led protests, he was told, you've done your bit, stay at home. It's our time.
Yes.
And then one of the hardest things that the system has found very difficult is because they say we are leaderless. We don't need any leader. Their leader, they say, it's like, it's God who is our leader now. We don't want any lead across the country. They have achieved what very few I've ever managed to achieve. But you know, one of the things that is good for this generation, they are very educated, they were focused. These are guys who were analyzing the finance bill to the details and to the letter and saying, why is that bit wrong? Why is the other one wrong? And even telling their MPs, their representative were inside parliament. And they told parliamentarians, fought no. But, and they'll give them reasons. Some of these guys in parliament, unfortunately, some of them don't even bother to read the bill. They are bribed and they vote.
Yes. And again, as you said, you know, this generation heavily involved with technology, it is their generation. And gone are the days of political being political divide or divided groups coming together, or what, just opposition looking to stage protest, and is heavily criticized because it's being prompted or fronted by politicians, is the opposition. And we've seen many protests, as you made mention there, by Ralo Dingo. But this is the beauty of what we're witnessing now. It has no ethnic or ethnicity bearing. This is just Kenyans who are feeling the hardship in the country. And if MPs are elected to represent the voices of the citizens, then they have to do as the citizens want. And, you know, it's interesting because watching what is transpiring in Kenya right now as we speak, Julius, I was just thinking, what does this actually mean? Because one will talk about democracy, which we're seeing right now. But I was actually the deeper I thought about this, the more I realized that this is an issue of the social contract and revolution. And when the social contract fails, or a government fails to fulfill its obligation, then a revolution will start. And this is what we're seeing now. I mean, if you look at the taxes, the tax hikes, what this budget actually entails is absolutely ridiculous. Knowing full well the economic challenges across the world and what people are facing right now, Kenyans are facing, and to introduce these taxes, it's absurd. And, you know, when there was this so-called, this forecast of economic hardship in, you know, around the world, some of our projections was we're going to see more demonstrations and more demonstrations and more demonstrations. And it had to take the people for the president to change his tone. Initially, we saw what we expected from most leaders, trying to be harsh and firm. But the people who, by the social contract, have allowed themselves to be governed by the government of the day have spoken. And the government has to adhere to what the people are saying. So what's happening in Kenya, if you read blogs and news articles in Ghana and you read the comments, people are actually saying, oh my goodness, we wish Ghanaians would be this bold and to stand and to fight and to let the government of the day know that they're not happy with some of these policies and to go further so their voices can be heard, other than being, you know, lied to and bribed and so on and so forth.
Indeed. And you see, one of the other things which was amazing, again, is the organization. Now, this brought all Kenyans now together. And you see, doctors, they went in the protest to treat people on site. Anyone? Immediate attention by doctors on site. Lawyers as well, they were in their hundreds. Anyone arrested, any police station, they'll get in there about 100 lawyers. Fishing them out. So this has brought amazing amount of unity. And you know, one thing they want to describe, Kenyans, tribeless, leaderless. Three key words. Any politicians coming closer, they say, we don't mind you support, but remember, we are leaderless. Because you know why that was important? All the time, all movements, you know, Jonas, they target the leaders.
Yes.
Given some money bribed, they betray the cause. They become Judas Iscariot of the time.
Yeah.
and the rest is history. But this one has beat politicians. Even now when the president is a government, they're like, we want to engage Gen Z. But they're like, but they have no leaders. And they are tribeless. And they are Kenyans.
That strategy is admirable. Because we see, as you made mention there, we see so many times where the leaders are so, or the so-called leaders have been corrupted, or we don't see or hear from them again. And as you made the biblical reference there, I also read somewhere that the president now is known as Zacchaeus, who was the tax collector during the time of Jesus Christ. And actually, that
he refused to climb down from the tree, and they said, "We are going to cut it now." It's away.
But we must commend their bravery. We must. And there's one lady in particular, you know, the picture is doing making rounds. And there's a lot of
one who was telling police officers, "We're also fighting for you."
Yes. Yes. And for me, that was the epitome of this movement. Because the taxes not only affecting young people, it's affecting those in public services as well. And, exactly. You know, in most African countries, Julius, what actually makes it difficult for anyone to fathom is the fact that a lot of these, you know, these bills are read in parliament, or they're read out in some terms where I think sometimes we do ourselves a disservice when it's not fully analyzed. And we expect some journalist who we think they're dead for the, you know, to serve the public and to inform the public and so on and so forth, absolutely fail to do what they're supposed to do. Okay, and some of these, I'm not saying all, because we're all in the same field, but we know what's going on. A lot of these media houses are owned by the politicians anyway, so most politicians are able to just get away with whatever they want to get away with, and before you know it, nothing is spoken of, and it's just, you know, business as usual. But the fact that young people have taken time to scrutinize this bill and to realize that no, this is to our detriment, and as such, we have to say something. We have to gather, and we have to get the ear of the president and the attention of the president. And I mean, you know, revolutions or trying to gain global attention, it's not just by sitting at home and just talking about it. You have to go out there if you want change, if you want to see change. And we have to commend these brave young boys and girls who have taken the lead to show that, no, we will hold you accountable. And this is not to us, that this is not to the benefit of us. And so you have to revoke or rescind this decision.
Colorful
Radio.
This is Colorful Radio.
Yeah, but the thing that surprises us, I mean, Jonas, I've done programs with you before, and one of the things is to see how Ruto has changed. When he came to the power, he spoke, a lot of Africans were happy. Let's hear, for example, what he was saying, what he was on about.
Financial institutions like TDB to be front and center in that conversation so that they can give our perspective from our continent in that debate so that we are not negatively profiled all the time as a risky destination for investment or for development financing. And please, DDB, don't join the people who profile us as a risky place. You should be the ones to say Africa is the best place to invest and that we are not risky at all. In fact, this is a continent that has the highest return on investment, and everybody should be heading in this direction because in any case, we are the continent of the future. At the International Monetary Fund, European nations took 160 billion of the 2021 issue of special drawing rights, compared to African countries' cumulative amount of 34 billion. I'm very happy that today we will be sharing some shares from TDB and we will be in a good place, different from the situation I'm describing here. An institutional blueprint which administers development financing this way must be changed urgently, and one made that is fit for purpose. The urgent need for socio-economic transformation must therefore translate into an even more urgent need to redesign the international financial institutions and also design and implement a wholly new global green bank to mobilize resources globally and administer them in a truly inclusive, representative, democratic, and equitable manner. Is that all we need to meet the fears urgency of now? Hardly. The Pan-African aspiration for socio-economic transformation based on Agenda 2063 looks at African solutions as the primary intervention in confronting African problems. At the forefront of this agenda is regional and continental integration aimed at unlocking Africa's potential on a scale that will make our continent the epicenter of a new industrial age. The Africa Continental Free Trade Area is both a continental and a global game changer. Its scale is unprecedented. The upshot is that it has already inaugurated a market with a population of 1.4 billion people, of the world's youngest people. The critical imperative in integration is the elimination of barriers and borders and the intensification of connectivity through road, rail, port, and fiber optic networks.
Let's focus on IMF and World Bank. When Ruto came into power, he criticized heavily World Bank, IMF, saying we need a new global infrastructure which will be fairer. He was keen on advocating Africa's single currency. He became a darling of Julius Malema that time, especially by advocating for Africa's single currency. And truly, when you look into the things he's talking about, IMF, he didn't have a lot of faith in that. Kenya had left the Bretton Woods institutions, your World Bank, IMF. They had looked China, they looked East. And actually, by the look of everything, the way he came campaigning against the dollar, if you remember, for the first time telling Kenyans they bought oil using Kenya shillings instead of the dollar. We thought maybe, if anything, Kenya may be much more allied to BRICS, where China, Russia, and others fall.
Brazil, South Africa. Yeah.
So what's happening here? Now then, he became the darling of the IMF and West World Bank.
it's interesting, Julius, because I think to appeal globally, I think it's one thing. It's almost as if his objective was to appease the global ears across the continent of Africa and Africanism, which is still very much alive. He wanted to be accepted, to be seen as somebody who's different from some of our leaders across the continent of Africa. But like the saying goes, charity begins at home. And if you don't keep your house in order, then whatever you say is meaningless. And this is what we're seeing now. It's interesting how we keep talking about the youthfulness of Africa, the youthfulness of Kenyans. Now they've spoken. And when I actually look at the bill and looking at some of the taxes that are being implemented, this is actually trying to stifle the future of the young generation. And one thing in particular was the levies on monetized digital content creation. which to me, it's almost as if, you know, there's lack of job creation. The youth have found the means, ways and means to create jobs for themselves through this digital age that we're in. And you see it fit to place taxes on that. Now, bear in mind, these guys have to fund themselves, get their own money, buy their equipment, everything, to create this community, this following, where they're able to make a living. And this is where the government is focusing to tax. And they're doing this through the conditions, the preconditions of the conditions set by the IMF. So saying that you're here for the youth and talking about the prosperity of the country, which is the youth, and on one hand, you're actually trying to cripple them and stifle their progress in the world, is something that people had to rise up. The youth had to rise up and just leave them to make the same mistakes. And you know how things are in Africa. The moment you challenge an elderly person, you must be put in your place. And this generation is saying, no, we're not going to have it. We're not going to have it. And by and large, it was a peaceful demonstration. They're making their voices heard. Yeah. And this is what they're supposed to do. So I'm really, really disappointed with the president, not to mention one of his campaign promises was about, you know, from the bottom up, trying to distinguish himself from, you know, the so previous leaders or politicians in that country, meaning that he feels the pain and what the average person in the country is going through. Now, you've been given the mandate because we believed what you were saying. We believed that you were the right person to help the youth. And now look at these taxes.
The most ridiculous ones, maybe perhaps, which is worth mentioning here, John, is imagine taxing children nappies. Imagine taxing sanitary towels, which are given free in other countries. And imagine putting tax on that. Imagine now you go to countryside, especially in many places in Africa, land is freehold, which means it will be free for your children, your great-grandchildren to inherit. Now, they were proposing to convert all land to be leasehold. What does that tell you? Upon the expiry of those years, government has mentioned, this is no longer your land. This is government's land.
Absolutely.
People accept that. A car, John, a car you bought with your money, or maybe you bought through a loan, bank loan, it's your car, it's your property. Government, after you paid all the things that you need to pay the government for, they come back and tell you because you own a car, each year you pay 2.5% for owning a car. Excuse me, did you help me buy it? I'm still paying loan. Do you want to chip in as government? So when you tax me, it can make some sense. It's a bit more like Jonas, poll tax in the UK.
Absolutely. Yes.
You know, she used to tax you because you were on her head. But the problem, they were not giving this tax to God because he's the one who gives us heads.
And Jesus, let me touch on this as soon as we're talking about IMF so that our listeners can actually see how detrimental it is to our nations, right? And I've said this, I think I've mentioned this in the show, one of our previous shows before, about Nigeria. And I think this was, I think, the early 70s to mid-70s, early 80s, where Nigeria had a really, really strong economy. And due to coup d'etats and, you know, the instability of the countries where soldiers actually took over, right? Now, due to Nigerian government at the time, inability to run the economy, then had to go and seek IMF bailout. Now, Nigeria at that time, you know, in terms of the textile manufacturing sector, Nigeria was booming. Okay, they more or less had like a 24-hour economy running, Nigeria at that time. And as soon as the IMF conditions came into play, the structural step, right? As soon as these conditions came into play, with that comes this, you know, you open up your market. you have to, there's so many conditions. One was, you know, tariff liberalization, which simply means lowering your import tariffs. So countries can just flood their goods into your country, which in effect will have a massive on local goods. But the textiles industry, for instance, was one, you know, contributing heavily to Nigeria's economy at that time. And that was one that got hit massively due to the IMF's condition. Because what happened was we saw an influx of textiles from India, from China, which were like secondhand goods, essentially, compared to the natural, the real textiles from the mainland. And in the end, crippled Nigeria's textiles industry. So this is what this IMF data has continued to do. You open up your market, you have to lower your taxes where they can bring in as many goods as they can, and then you're competing with the outside world because you're part of the global economy. So let's not for one second think that going for IMF is a way to help, because it doesn't. It doesn't help anybody. In the end, it's the citizens who will suffer. Politicians will not suffer. Politicians will never suffer. They'll have to make cuts to, you know, look, useless taxes on sanitary pads. Sanitary pads we're talking about. And we know how women or children are impacted across the world, let alone across the continent of Africa. And, you know, I remember looking at one study from the World Bank. Yes. I'm talking of describing what actually, how it impacts young girls from, you know, seeking education. The lack of sanitary pads being made available to them. So now imagine this. And if you look at the GDP per capita in Kenya, and, you know, an average person who is struggling, let alone to put food on the table, with family, and then you expect them to pay these taxes to look after their little children, the girls, the young girls, and they have to pay taxes. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. So I will keep commending the brave people, the brave young people of Kenya, that IMF has never been good, especially when it comes to the continent of Africa. We can go through, we can look at Ghana, we can look at Nigeria, we can look at most countries that have seeked IMF bailout, and look at the position right now. It doesn't paint a good picture at all.
The question is, what did they do to Ruto? When he came to power, he was very focused. He was seeing those things clearly. He was calling for a fairer global financial system, fairer than IMF, the World Bank. You know, as a politician, he must have seen the WhatsApps did before. So, but there's a lot of issues happening. And of course, we see the controversy sending Kenyan police to Haiti. And all these, so there's a lot of things happening. I think he tried to look a bit more ways this time round. I don't know what he's going to say to the BRICS, because Kenya was a friend to them too.
This is Colorful Radio.
So, to see today, 2024, military on the street just because Kenyans protested, it doesn't send a very good signal.
No, it doesn't. And I'm not surprised, Julius, because when, you know, the protests started and, you know, going to the House of Parliament, and, you know, we saw what President Ruto said, which he said that he described the protest as treasonous. And then, of course, later on, changed his tone, talking about he believes in democracy. And if we're seeing the military being deployed onto the streets, then, hey, the effect or the impact of the protest is really, really getting to the precedent. And B, you cannot turn the military against the people. And I think anyone or any leader that we've seen in the past trying to deploy the military and turn the military against the people, they end up being ousted of office because the people will not succumb to the pressure of the military. We've seen it. It doesn't go well. And the moment the people whom you're claiming to govern and you're turning the military against them, what tends to happen is you have nobody to govern because the protests will not end. It will be a constant thing. And by the looks of it, people are willing to put their lives on the line for that change. And I think there's something happening here. And the protesters have realized it's almost as if, for the lack of a better term, they can smell blood. Because he wanted to be the strong man, as it were, okay, to more or less condemn the protest that's happening. And I also read somewhere him saying that, you know, the police that were firing live ammunition, where they were deemed as always bandits who have hijacked this, and, you know, trying to more or less discredit what's happening and to put the blame on the security or what, you know, people have lost their lives because of this. But what he doesn't realize, or I think he's been caught by surprise, is people are willing, because right now it's no more about just, you know, the rescinding a decision or canceling the bill, which he said that, you know, he's a listening president, he's listening. He should have listened before getting to this stage. Yes, before getting to this stage. So I think the protesters have realized that, okay, we're making some grounds here, and we're not ending, we're not stopping, and the protests will not stop. Hence the deployment of the military, which I think is a bad and wrong signal, because what this is going to do is to encourage the protesters even more, and for people to realize that, or people to believe that the narrative of people trying to cling onto power by using the military against their own people. And I think it's a very, very dangerous territory that the president is heading into now by deploying the military. You don't deploy military. You're not fighting the war.
Yeah. Can I also point out that today I saw a clip of a police officer shouting, saying, "I'm tired. If you want, sack me now. I want to ask the government, why can't you be fair to these people?" A police officer. Now, that should send a signal. Look. This military, they're soldiers, but they are someone's children.
Of course.
Parents are Kenyans. They're somebody's brother. Mm-hmm. They're somebody's sister. Mm-hmm. And they're Kenyans. So whatever the other Kenyans are going through, they are not exceptional.
Absolutely.
They're going through the same thing. And they can see the point. Why would you, if I'm a soldier, why would you issue a command for me to shoot someone because of things I'm going through myself? And they're saying,
yeah,
pushing us beyond our capability to persevere.
Yeah.
They won't. And what does that tell you? You know, when you think, though the military are united behind you, get a shock of your life.
No.
Get a shock of your life. There are those who have liked you, others have hated you. That's life. So you don't do military and politics. It's not a very good combination.
No, it's not. And this is my point, because I think there must be some sort of pressure coming from somewhere within, you know, because for anyone to deploy military, you have the police, not military. This is not a war. Not one, you know, having heard of anybody using any ammunition or targeting police or military or anything, or because they destroyed the edifice in some parts of the country. This is nothing. These people pouring out their frustration, and you have to listen to them. And I think it's a bad move. It's setting a bad precedent, and I think this will only encourage the protesters. And, you know, in politics, you have to seize the moment. You have to know how to maneuver. You don't add salt into injury. Somebody that is determined at all costs, you don't build up a big wall and saying that I have the powers to crush you, because essentially that's a signal you're sending out there, that I have the powers to crush you if you want to take this in further. And I think it's such a bad move.
Let's also look at it this way. You're the commander-in-chief, yeah? And if you're the commander-in-chief, you have been defeated to handle a political argument. What are you telling those whom you command? You are a failure. You can't negotiate your way. You can't debate issues. You are defeated. That's why one signal you are sending.
Absolutely, Julius. And you know, I go back to my initial comments that anything that arises, especially to do with many African leaders, is the heavy hand. And I think this is where we get it wrong. You know, it's worked in the past years. It's worked where you've seen military men and, you know, people being picked up at 12 o'clock in the morning and trying to put fear, incite fear into the people. So I think his initial move, to me, was a sign of weakness. And trying to use the, you know, the strong man mentality or argument was a sign of weakness, because in the end, you back down. You back down. And trying to show them that, okay, even though I back down, if you're trying to go any further, I'm deploying military. A will only again reignite the fight and the spirit, because now it's almost as if there's a cause to be fought for. And you cannot turn the military against the people. It will not, it's not going to work. It's unsustainable. Before you realize, the military will then come to you and say, look, this is not what we swore an oath to be, an oath for. To protect the country. To protect the country is to protect the citizens. Not to protect the president. It's the citizen.
Exactly.
And this is, like you said, this is a political issue. This has nothing to do with military. It has nothing to do with military. So as a president who has been elected, and there's a crisis in your country, and you cannot find any other means to appease the people but to deploy the military, then there's a big problem ahead. You know, as you're saying, there's no sense of leadership. It's non-existence.
And when you look at it, Jonas, you're talking about when actually at the heat of the Gen Z protest, that is the day Ruto flagged off the first bunch of Kenyan police to Haiti.
Yeah.
So Kenyans are asking, which is a valid question. Our police is so powerful and knowledgeable, and they know everything to the level that they are going to sort out Haitian gang that has defeated its government, assassinated their president, told their prime minister not to come back after he came back and he never went back. Our police is the one to sort those gangs. They're so strong. Why can't they handle their own citizens?
Affairs. Yes, and I keep coming back to the military, Julius. What is the essence of the military? It's to fight and defend the country. That's the priority. They've sworn oath to do that. Okay? The police and, you know, in this you deploy police, not military. You do not deploy the military. And the moment you do that, is like I keep saying, you keep sending a whole different signal. And again, if Ruto, let's say for instance, and I'm nowhere near, you know, President Ruto or anything, but, you know, we study politics. We've seen so many things happen in the world of politics. And as a president, you know, Ruto fairly seems like, you know, a young person who is not too detached from the young generation, one would assume. And I think with this kind of unrest, I think you have to meet the situation. You have to meet them head on. How are you able to interact with these people? You don't sit in the comfort of your home and make a press and you know, release a press statement or make a statement, a televised broadcast in the comfort of your home. Go out there to meet these people and speak to these people. Speak to them. They are your children. You are the father of the land. Speak to them. Engage with them. There's no need for military. There's no need for military. Engage with them. Or if you want, okay, you want to support the military to make sure there's peace, whatever, that's fine. Even though there's no war happening in Kenya. Go and speak to them. Go and speak to them. And the moment we realize that this generation is not about using the heavy hand or coming down on them like a ton of bricks and telling them, instructing them, the better it will be for many of our leaders. It's about engagement, because these guys, as you made mention there, are highly educated. When I was listening to the young people explaining the intricacies of getting involved with IMF, I was shocked. I was shocked. They're fully aware, politically aware of what is going on and what the implications are. Engage with them. And you go far. You go far because at the end of the day, Kenya is their land. It's their land. It is everybody's land. It's just like I said earlier on, the social contract between the citizens and the state. And if something is going amiss, it's down for the state to go down and talk to the citizens and explain rather than sitting in your high offices and giving instructions, because that's not going to work.
No, it's not going. It's about persuading. It's about negotiating your way.
Yes.
It's about knowing these people. They know what's going on. They are not, you know, the problem is, and you know, Jonas, even myself, I used to kind of despair when I thought about change in Africa. Because you scan around across the continent of Africa, youth, people who are educated, you thought, these guys are always on TikTok. It's all about entertainment and laughs and pranks being played and saying silly things. And this is what the generation is all about. That was initial perception of by men held by many people. I would surprise you, Jonas, the first reaction when Gen Z went to protest. One of the, I think is the leader of opposition, leader of the majority National Assembly, Kenya, Kimani Ichung'wah. This is the way he described the youth he has seen on the ground protesting. It was like, these are guys who are holding iPhones. They are dropped by Uber taxi and they are going to eat KFC. They don't know problems.
Colorful radio.
Wow.
Yep, that was the initial reaction. But I tell you, one of the lessons the current MPs will forever remember in their lives. Even on social media, they didn't have to talk or say anything. Because when you say something silly, they will call you a cow. And there was a song for a cow. They put your picture there. And that song keeps on playing on TikTok. And it goes something like, a cow will always be a cow. Even if you put honey on it, it doesn't change. Even if you hold a Bible above its head, it never changes. A cow will always be a cow. You don't joke with these guys. Then there's this another MP. He was voting for the bill. He looks out. He begins to tell parliamentarians, I'm a photo editor. What you are seeing is not real. These are photos that have been photoshopped, manipulated. They're not even Kenyan photos. He wished he'd never said that because he could have parted his head and mouth and started to make him talk as if he was barking.
Yes.
And they'll play all the clips of real footages of Kenyan process protesting on TikTok and bringing his picture there. And at the end, they used to slap his head off. Oh my God. No, you don't. There are things you can't say. You just can't say.
No.
You just need to sit back and listen a bit more. You may capture with the changes.
Yeah.
Even now the regime, right? They are blaming the head of intelligence, something I found very ridiculous. Number one, matters of national security, you don't talk to that in public. If you have a problem with that, there's a way to address that. You don't tell people on telly they failed to brief the president. But I'm like, it's because these people have been insulated so much. Jonas, it's like they live in a different planet. Because they are real country. If you are president or anyone, tell me you don't have a TV. When you watch TV, each city in the country, one song, do you need extra intelligence briefings? Isn't that obvious enough? What else do you want?
I totally agree with you, Julius. And again, you know, the power of social media cannot be underestimated. at all. And I think, you know, like you said, many people made the same assertion of, you know, this young generation. They just, you know, they describe them as microwave generation. Like they just want everything quick. You know, they're not politically inclined and they just want the easy way out. But, you know, I totally disagree with that. Because what they've been able to do in times of crisis, you know, many people before have not been able to do so. And they understand, you know, and I think this is what's going to break that division or divisiveness of, you know, tribal or political allegiances. And I think this is what will break that mold. Because when it's affecting A, it's also affecting B. It doesn't matter which political party you're affiliated with. We're all going through the same hardship, the same problem. So if political leaders are just sitting there thinking that they're getting on with their business, that nobody knows what's going on, then they've got another thing coming. And I just hope that they continue to have this courage and push and keep pushing and to be able to reach their objectives and goals, because it will spark a whole kind of movement across the entire continent of Africa. This is not, you know, being hijacked by any political leaders or external forces. This is to show the people, citizens in respective countries, that if you're unhappy with how things are being done in your country by your state, you have every right. It is your right. And it's the government's duty to protect your right and for you to exercise that right. Because at the end of the day, it cannot be a state with no country to govern without governing the citizens. It cannot be classified as a sovereign state. It cannot, because who are you governing? And then they'll start to listen. You know, this is not the first time President Ruto has heard this coming from Kenyans. It's not the first time. But it gets to a point where if nothing is being done, action being taken, then you have to take the extra step. You have to go the extra step. And it takes courage and willingness. And, you know, the Gen Z have shown that they're more than capable of doing so. And it's all about, you know, a lot of the times, Julius, we talk about patriotism and we think this young generation don't really know about patriotism. The older generation, that they believed in the country so much, but nothing beats this. This is patriotism. Because you have people screaming and shouting that this is my country, this is my land, I'm Kenyan, I'm fighting. And this is what it takes. You said we're living by democracy. There's nothing, you know, this is the beauty of democracy. And when that social contract is broken, then this is what will happen. This is what we're seeing right now in Kenya.
It's I'm the happiest because one of the things I've noted now is just to see the knowledge these guys have. It's just to see the passion that they have. It's just wonderful to see how they can exercise their rights, how they know their rights, and how they really can push them across until you listen, even if you are not listening. So, and also the idea that they can actually discipline themselves. You don't even need anyone coach to monitor them or control. They are 100% disciplined before they go to the field. They are agreed what to do in every eventuality. And they have a strategy which was always ahead of these other guys. So one of the challenging things for this system to control these youths, but you know it's not youths; it's all Kenyans now involved.
Yes, yeah,
and on a very big scale. So I think to see military cutting the streets of Nairobi for me is in bad taste. It reminds me of early 90s, of course, we had President Moi. He used to really be hard on Kenyans because he also met a lot of opposition. He was opposed by many people, so he was extremely harsh. Of course, some people used to call him dictator. So people would be rounded up, detained without trial, and all those things. But I remember when people began to fight for change, which is what we call the second liberalization. Mm-hmm. And I remember a famous cartoonist. He drew a very amazing cartoon. And this cartoon had the map of Kenya, and on the boundary of between Kenya and other countries, we had our soldiers standing there. But because the inside of Kenya was hotter than outside, the soldiers had pointed their guns towards Kenya. And then a rocket comes from Somalia, lands inside Kenya, and they all jump. They're like, where is that one from? It was classic cartoon. I've never forgotten, especially given that particular time. Yeah. So we want to tell Ruto, let the military go back to the boundaries. Let their guns face away from Kenya. Defend the country from external attack. Kenyans are not your enemies. That is a key message.
Absolutely.
If the police are so capable that we can imagine even sending them to Haiti to sort the gangs there, these Kenyans are peaceful. They are unharmed.
Absolutely. 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 And you know, before coming on here, Julius, I was just trying to find a simple way to describe revolution. And I came across this on the National Geographic Society, and on one of their pages, which they talk about throughout the time how revolutions have taken place and changed the course of society. And you know, I just want to just touch on one thing, because even, you know, right up onto the Enlightenment era, you know, it was all about the monarchs, and you know, it's God who ordained the king, and everything is by the king. So people actually stood and protest to bring about change. And for me, this is what we're seeing. And you know, they go on to talk about this, where they said the Greek philosopher Aristo linked revolution to a number of causes and conditions, but largely to the desire for equality and honor. Plato linked revolution to society decay. He believed that revolutions occur when institutions such as church or state fail to instill in society a system of values and a code of ethics that prevents upheaval. I'll go to the former one, which